Hello and welcome to episode number 19 of The Music Plays the Band. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I hope you're all safe and well today. It is great to be with you today. We were off this past weekend, so it was nice to be home with the family for a little bit. And honestly, it was also nice not having to worry about staying safe on the road. Things are heading in the wrong direction right now. I think we all know that. And we're seeing way too many of our musical brothers and sisters having to cancel shows right now. Hopefully we can all get on board with what needs to be done and try again to regain some normalcy like we had earlier in the summer. You know, we were on the right path and we were heading the right direction, and then, you know, it all kind of went to hell. Anyway, my featured guest today is drummer Jay Lane. Jay is an amazing drummer who's comfortable in all styles, whether he was hitting hard in his days with Primus, interpreting the Dead with Rat Dog, or now showing a little bit more subtle side with Wolf Brothers. I learn something new every time I watch him. Been a big fan for a long time, great guy, and it was really great to have this conversation. Also with me today is Garrett DeLoyan to talk about his band Jerry's Middle Finger and interpreting the Jerry Garcia Band catalog. Before we get started, I appeal to you once again to support the podcast in any way you can. There's a monthly Patreon subscription which gives you exclusive bonus content including outtakes, expanded interviews and segments, videos and stories from the road, community hang time with me, and much, much more. You can also make a one-time contribution through PayPal, and a portion of all the proceeds goes to the Rex Foundation, the charity started by the Grateful Dead. You can find out about all of this and more at www.themusicplaystheband.net. And wherever you are listening to the podcast, please rate, like, and review. Thanks for being here. Now let's get right to it. Black Music Moment is brought to you by The Clean Store, brandingandapparel.com for all your branding and apparel needs. Technology-driven solutions and concierge service for managing programs of all sizes. The Black Music Moment is our attempt at chronicling the profound influence of black music and musicians on the Grateful Dead and the Jerry Garcia Band, and today we honor Jimmy Cliff. Jimmy Cliff was born James Chambers in 1944 in St. James, Jamaica. He began writing songs while still in primary school, and when he was 14, his father took him to Kingston, where he would take up the stage name Jimmy Cliff. He was not afraid to try and make it at a young age, and he worked hard to get his career started. He sought out producers, played talent shows, and hustled his name all around Kingston. He got a record deal, and after two singles failed to make much of an impression, his career took off when Hurricane Hattie became a hit when he was still just 14 years of age. In 1972, he starred in the movie The Harder They Come, whose incredible soundtrack helped bring reggae music to the world. He has won Grammy Awards, appeared in multiple movies, and contributed to many social causes, including USA for Africa and the Artists United Against Apartheid, who recorded the song Sun City in 1985. He's collaborated with many artists along the way, including Annie Lennox, Stephen Van Zandt, and Sting. And even though he tackles some heavy content, his songs are so uplifting, whether it's because of the up-tempo reggae grooves or his soulful voice. His song Many Rivers to Cross never, ever fails to make my hair stand up. It's one of my all-time favorite songs. I don't understand how you can't get chills every time you hear it, especially when you see it. I got to see him open up for the Dead in 1988 in Eugene, Oregon, and what a great show. Jerry Garcia was a big fan of Jimmy Cliff as well, and probably for the same reasons I just stated. His songs were groovy, poignant, and were also great vehicles for jamming. Garcia was performing them as early as 1973, and over the years he covered Sitting in Limbo, Struggling Man, and the song we're about to hear, The Harder They Come. Cliff originally recorded it in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that's the home of Donna Jean Gatto, in 1971, but redid it to be used as the title track for the movie in 1972. Garcia performed it over 350 times beginning the very next year. Over the years, with all his different lineups, Jerry really played around with the rhythm and the feel of this tune. I just went back and listened to a whole bunch of them, and they're all so different, but they still keep the vibe of the original. So here is Jimmy Cliff, and I guess this would be the second original, the 1972 version of The Harder They Come.
Seem to hear even your cry. So
Today's edition of There Is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Town is brought to you by the Authenticity Academy, offering you online courses and private coaching. If you're feeling stuck or confused about the direction your life is going in, or you've lost touch with your authentic self, the Authenticity Academy is here to help. www.authenticity.coach. So we're heading out to California today to talk to Garrett DeLoyan, lead guitarist for Jerry's Middle Finger, based in Los Angeles. They do the Jerry Band thing a little bit more than they do the Grateful Dead thing. Before we get started on this one, I gotta tell you, I made a mistake. I'm still a rookie at this, you know, even though we're 19 episodes in, and I didn't quite set my levels quite properly, so my voice might be a little difficult to hear, but I'm not the one you want to listen to anyway on this. Garrett's the one who's got all the cool info. So I apologize ahead of time for the little audio snafu. And here we go. It's a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so I'm here today talking with Garrett DeLoyan out in Los Angeles. Garrett is the guitar player for a band called Jerry's Middle Finger. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. It's very nice to join you today. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. You know, it's a crazy time, but we're all getting through it. And you guys have been playing. I know that because we just saw you weeks ago Northern California, in Mendocino.
The old Black Oak Ranch.
Yeah, the Dust Bowl. It was dusty.
Yes, it was. The Brown Burger Bowl.
So you guys, you take a little bit, Jerry's Middle Finger has a little bit of a different take on it because you guys primarily cover the Jerry Garcia Band, correct?
Yes, that's kind of our focus with this project, for sure.
Can you kind of give us a brief rundown on the history and how y'all got started?
Sure. It's kind of a funny story, really. I mean, my friend Rodney, who plays drums for the band, he's really more or less the guy that takes care of driving the ship mostly these days. But he and I have been friends for a long time. I think we met in 92 and we've played music together since then. I think we started JMF around, 2010 or 11. 12, somewhere in there, and basically kind of just something to do. We love the music. We wanted to play. So we found some people and got together and started doing this. And the funny thing to me is that we called it Jerry's Middle Finger mainly because we just needed something to call it. But we never really realized it would turn into anything legitimate. So to this day, I find myself chuckle when somebody will ask me the name of the band or I see it and I'm like, I can't believe it's called Jerry's Middle Finger. Like we sort of meant that as a joke. So that, over the years, we've added a few musicians to the band. We've had a few changes and we've mostly just done it as a grassroots kind of on our own. Rodney's taken care of all the booking and stuff like that up to this point, and we're happily continuing forward.
So is the instrumentation straight Garcia Band style with two female singers and all of that?
Yes. Currently, we have drums, bass, keys, guitar, two female vocalists, and myself. So it's very much situated the way JGB was.
Towards in the 80s style.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
And how often now, or in a normal time even, how often would you all be playing?
I would say probably a busy month for JMF, if we were really working as we normally would be probably every couple of weekends or so, maybe six shows a month, something like that. Everybody in the band has some kind of a career and family life aside from just JMF, except for myself. Some folks have kids and dental careers and things like that, so it's tough for us to travel a lot. We try to do more like weekends and special, you know, outings here and there and make it logistically feasible. So we're not hammering it too hard, but maybe five shows a month.
But you definitely get outside of LA.
For sure. I would say most of our gigs are actually up north. We work primarily, I'd say, in the Bay Area more so than LA.
Gotcha. How did you guys decide to take the JGB approach as opposed to the Grateful Dead or a combination of the two?
For me, I think the catalog, the JGB catalog, is just a little bit more suited to what I really enjoy as a player. And the songs are they're a little bit more familiar in the sense of like they're a little bit more rootsy. Grateful Dead music obviously is also embedded in there, but it's much more difficult. And for me, I think in order to really pull off a Grateful Dead type of an ensemble, it requires a lot more, personnel and gear that we are willing or able currently to sort of do. I mean, I must give you some props. You guys are my favorite. I mean, when I found DSO, I'm trying to remember when my first DSO show was. It was pretty early. But when I found you guys, I was like, wow, now here's a group of guys who are really going after this thing the right way. It's got the essence. And that's what's missing from most projects, if you ask me, is the essence. Right. So I've tried to focus on the essence of JGB just because it's a lot more approachable as a musician.
Do you notice a big difference? I'm sure you do. Let me rephrase all of this. What would you say is the biggest difference in Garcia's style, playing-wise, between what he's doing in JGB and what he does in The Grateful Dead?
I would say in The Grateful Dead setting, Jerry was able to, I think, maybe take more risks and try certainly things that were way outside of the parameters of just typical framework of typical music. Roots music, where he was able to really take things out there. Now, he did that in JGB as well in certain numbers, but I think he had a greater palette of expression with the Grateful Dead in simply taking risks type of way, where in JGB, playing things a little bit more straight and gospel-y, a lot more focused on the fundamentals of blues and things like that.
Right on. I'm going to take that question a step further then. Obviously, you're a huge student of the Jerry Garcia Band stuff. You had so many different style lineups over the years, you know, going back into the mid-70s through the 90s. You'd have a synth player, then have a piano player. You'd have no backup vocals. You'd have one backup vocal. You'd have two. Went through about 30 different drummers. But over time, the constant, obviously, was Jerry and Con for the most part. But, the constants, Jerry, as you listen to all of that music, what is the differences in his playing over time in that band? What's your perception of how his playing evolved or changed?
That's a great question. I find, as I think about it, Jerry's playing did certainly change quite a bit through the years. Like, I noticed that in the earlier years of JGB, certainly with the early projects that he was working on, it had a more mellow approach. Around the late 70s, 77, 78, Jerry certainly kind of took on a different vibe. I think he had a lot more fire in his playing and performance. Certainly 78, you can see him just going for it. And then in 79, I think the biggest change was the change in his tone. And that's where things really, for me, like change. So sort of like when the Tiger tone happened in 79 and 80, going forward from there, things took on a new dimension. And I don't know, I feel like he found his voice in that instrument. And that's when he sort of cultivated it from there, I think. Stylistically, I think Jerry remained fairly much himself throughout those years. But I think there was just more fire towards the later part of the 80s and so forth. Yeah.
Right on. It's interesting to hear you talk about that, because, you know, we've done over the years, for whatever reasons, we've had to do a bunch of JGB shows over the years, you know, and we'll keep that same thing like we do with the Dead. You know, we'll pick a show and listen back. So, you know, we might have done a 90 show and we might have done a 76 show, and how different they are.
Yeah.
And like 76 is so slow.
Yeah.
Still groovy as can be, man.
Real buttery, though.
Buttery, great word.
Yeah.
You know, it's listening to it with all the different drummers, it really shows you how a drummer can change the style of a band.
Totally.
Listening to the same song from these different eras with different drummers, how it changes.
Totally. And you mentioned Ozzy Allers, the synth player. That era of JGB music confounds me to no end, because it's a four piece and you have Ozzy Allers, who's doing something that's like stylistically to my ear, completely different than what Jerry's doing. Yet the grin on Jerry's face tells you all you need to know. He's like completely into it. And
right. He's
like, go for it. You know, and Ozzy's doing these crazy synthy tone wheel stuff. And I'm like, how does this fit? But somehow it worked.
So now, you know, we've talked about all these different ways, you know, how it evolved or changed. Do you personally, and with the band, I guess, do you guys take a specific approach to interpreting and performing the music?
No, not really. In fact, since we don't necessarily recreate specific shows, we'll just do a song list or a set list, make a playlist. And sometimes the playlist will pull tracks from live recordings, all different eras, which kind of makes it interesting. Cause when we'll show up for the gig, some guys have listened to a 76 version. Some guys listen to a 82 version, and we'll sort of leave it to the rhythm section more or less to give me the feel. What do you guys feel like? Do you want to play it slow and buttery, or do you feel like really punching it? So we'll vary it up. And I feel like what we try to do is more or less interpret the music, but we play it like individuals. We're not necessarily trying to note for note recreate it, but just interpret it with that essence, you know, like, right. Yeah,
I get that very much. So, I often ask in this segment, you know, I ask about, usually we're talking about Grateful Dead specifically as opposed to JGB because of the musicians I've had on, but I'm going to take this with the JGB angle. We have this great subculture, this community of like-minded people. And whether they're here because of the Grateful Dead and then they got into JGB, or whether they're here about because of JGB, it doesn't really matter. They're all here because they're fans of this amazing music. But what is it about this music, do you think, in your perception, what is it about this music that creates this like-minded subculture?
Well, it's interesting because I never got to see the Jerry Garcia band with Jerry.
Me neither.
I saw the Grateful Dead for the first time in 1990. I was 18 years old, and I had missed them in 87 because I was too young. But I had started listening to them in 87, 86, I think. And the thing about it was, when I dropped the needle on that first Grateful Dead record, there was something about it I just could not put my finger on, but I could not stop listening to it. I couldn't stop sort of analyzing it, trying to figure out, what is this? It was like, I had never seen anything like it. So I think that what has happened as a result of this is that we have a like-minded community of people who similarly recognize something very unique. And with modern music, you know, stylistically, there's obviously these different genres of music. And I feel as though the Grateful Dead were able to manifest a new set of standards which will stand the test of time. And that's what's so amazing about it, is that you can bring together a group of like-minded musicians who have discovered this thing, and without ever rehearsing, without ever really discussing it, you could set up and play knowing which role everyone is playing as though these are standards, and the music will happen. I think is the magic thing about it.
I agree wholeheartedly, man. That's an awesome answer. And the fact that you're out there keeping that Jerry Garcia band music going for everybody is really cool, because there's not a whole lot of bands that are just dedicated to that. You know, the Dead bands will throw in a tune, including us. We'll throw in a tune here and there. And it's great. You know, I love to play, I'll take a melody in the middle of a set where we're doing Dead tunes and you throw that in. But you guys are really out there just helping people get turned on to the Jerry Garcia band stuff, or stay in touch with it who had it before.
That's it.
That's so much, man.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time with me today. That is from Jerry's Middle Finger out of Los Angeles, but playing all up and down the West Coast. It's Garrett Doyle. Thank you so much, my friend.
I really appreciate you having me, and I can't wait to see you guys again soon.
My pleasure.
All right, that was great. I want to thank Garrett for taking the time today, and that was a little snippet of Jerry's Middle Finger you heard right there. They sound really, really good. If you like what you are hearing today and would like to support the podcast, we have two different ways for you to do that. You can make a one-time contribution via PayPal or become a patron with a monthly subscription that includes expanded video versions of our segments, all the outtakes that don't make it onto the podcast, community hang time, videos I put together from home and on the road, including a bunch of rare DSO footage, which has been a whole lot of fun to go through. You can support the cause, learn more about the podcast and our sponsors, read the blog, or contact me through our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. And if you have time, please like, rate, and review the podcast on whatever player you might use. Thanks for your continued support and for helping me spread the word about the podcast. I really appreciate all your efforts. Our feature conversation today is brought to you by Grateful Sweats. On Shakedown or online, go to Grateful Sweats for subtle dead designs. Search Grateful Sweats on Etsy and see for yourself. Designs only other heads will get. When you're wearing the state of Tennessee with Jed in it and someone says nice shirt, you know they're on the bus. The cap with a single finger in the air makes its point, and you can look great on tour with men's and ladies' tees and tanks, caps, pins, and clearance items as low as $5. Get them at www.etsy.com/shop/gratefulsweats or click from the sponsors link on our website, themusicplaystheband.net. Or if you're out there seeing any fish shows this summer and all the Dead & Company shows, I know that Grateful Sweats is set up in the parking lot, so you can go visit them there as well. Tell them I sent you. My guest today is Jay Lane, drummer for a lot of things. He was one of the earlier drummers in Primus before joining forces with Bob Weir and Rob Wasserman and pretty much forming Rat Dog in the mid-90s. And he's been a constant in any Weir project since then, including the current group Wolf Brothers. He plays in quite a few other Dead-related projects, as well as jazz gigs and all kinds of other stuff. We always have great conversations when we're hanging out, and this one felt super relaxed, kind of just like we were sitting around backstage. Besides his playing, one of the things I love about Jay is his candor, and there's a lot of great insight in this one. So here you go, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jay Lane. All right, so I am here today with Jay Lane. How are you, my friend?
Good, brother.
You're home in San Francisco?
Yes, I am.
And now, did you grow up in San Francisco?
Yeah, man. I'm like one of the only ones left. I mean, there might be a couple of us, but this city was extremely gentrified by the whole Silicon Valley, revolution. And I'm like the local in the college town, basically. I've been here the whole time.
Tell me, man, growing up in San Francisco, then can you give us a little bit of a, tell us a little about your musical upbringing, when you started, how you got into playing and all that.
So my mom, I think since I was adopted, and she knew that I was a child of some sort of musician or some sort of thing. I think she found out enough that I was some sort of summer of love. Love child or something like that, you know, probably what back when it was actually the summer of love, like earlier 60s, you know, not. And somehow she thought I needed to have some sort of music in my life. Of course, she's founded Head Start, so she's all on top of, she's super progressive. She's on McCarthy's blacklist, man. That's how hip she was. So she took me around. I'll never forget. I was 9 years old. She took me around looking for some sort of musical instruction place. We went to a Yamaha piano school and went to another group lesson kind of thing. I didn't seem to take to any of it. And then we ended up at this guy, private teacher's studio. He had like a basement studio with like eggshell cartons and carpets and just on the walls. And it's totally like, you know, dead 70s studio, basement studio kind of vibe. And I was in love. And he was a drum teacher. And it was a single, it was like, one-on-one lessons. Right. So I was like, yes, this is what I want to do. And then, after a few years of that, you know, I wouldn't practice. So she would tell me if I didn't practice, if the teacher told her I wasn't practicing, then she'd stop paying for lessons. Well, she ended up doing that, but I ended up having a drum set in my room after that. So I think that's how we all really got going, right? Our parents were cool enough to let us have a drum set in our room.
It took me 2 years, though. I had to do just snare drum first for like 2 years before my teacher let me have a kick drum and all that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, my teacher did that, too. I did the practice pads and then finally snare drum and stuff.
But
And I had a practice pad set before I could even have a room set. I had a practice pad set. But
the thing is, we would like, I'm sure you were the same way. I'd try and get my lesson shit, you know, I'd blow through it because I didn't really care that much about it. And all I wanted to do was get the headphones on and start playing along to songs and figuring that shit out on my own. So I didn't spend nearly as much time doing what I was supposed to be being taught.
Exactly, man. I still love to set up my stereo. I don't know if you did this, but set up your stereo speakers right on the, like right behind your cymbals. So this, your stereo is sitting there blaring.
Yep.
As you're playing the drums, the stereos is right on the other side of the drum set. I used to get so many complaints from the neighbors. So that's how cool my mom was, man. You know, like, regardless of what the neighbors were complaining all the time or whatever, she let me make that noise. And again, like, she was 56 when she adopted me, man. So imagine, like, this is probably like, you know, she's 70 years old putting up with this fucking 14-year-old kid banging on drums and shit, you know. So that was pretty amazing, man. I'm pretty lucky, you know.
So you just took those 2 years of lessons then? That was it? And the rest is self-taught?
Well, I took this 2 years of lessons, and then I started taking from another. He recommended another teacher for me. The first guy's name was Bob Rose, and he recommended a guy named Steve Savage, who actually started Blue Bear School of Music, which is here in San Francisco. He started back then, but he was a drum teacher also, and I took from him for a little while. But then I stopped taking lessons. But what happened was, I went to junior high school shortly thereafter. And I was, you know, I got to play the drums in the jazz band in junior high school, and the teacher turned me on to Weather Report, the jazz group.
Right.
And I was like 14 years old, and that shit just like ended me. You know, I mean, I was just like, that was it. I was blast off into. I mean, of course, I loved music before that. I loved. I was really into when I was young. I liked Elton John a lot. I liked the Osmonds, Jackson 5. I ended up listening to a lot of stuff like Brass Construction. I listened to War, a lot of urban stuff, Earth, Wind, and Fire. My mom took me to a garage sale when I was, I was probably 12 years old or something. And there was a bunch of records. I started flipping through the records. I was so bored. I did not want to be there at all. And it was like one of those community things where it's like, you got to go with your mom. It's like, oh God, like nothing. There's nothing here for me. So I started looking through these records. So I see this one record with all this cartoon stuff on it. And it was standing on the verge of getting it on, the Funkadelic. And I was like, oh, I want this, mom. And you know, check this out. So she was hella cool. So she got me that album. I listened to that thing all the time. So then I knew who Funkadelic was. And then also being in, being in San Francisco with a bunch of, you know, urban kids, when the Flashlight album, the Parliament Flashlight album came out in 77, that was like a huge big thing, you know, Flashlight, you know, that song. I remember going to the record store and I was gravitating towards the Ohio Players. I actually love the Ohio Players a lot. And I went to see, that was actually one of the first concerts I actually got to see was the Fire Tour. You know, Fire Banner. Yeah. Saw that tour. I was gravitating towards those albums. So then fast forward, you know, I'm in junior high school. Love Weather Report. Jazzed out of my mind. Funk also. Prince comes out. That's the end of me. Like, you know, Prince 1984. I'm 20 years old. That's like the shit. I didn't wear eyeliner, but I didn't have the jacket, but you know, I had the hair. So, and everybody else did too. But the thing was, my only experience with the Grateful Dead at that time was I had a buddy from music camp. Well, I guess I got to add that my mom also was cool enough to send me to this Berkeley run music camp up in the Russian River that were actually like people like Whoopi Goldberg, Bobby McFerrin, and a bunch of local jazz guys that never really made it big were up there. Actually, Whoopi Goldberg and Bobby McFerrin were up there before they got famous. Before he did Don't Worry, be happy, and before she did Color Purple or Mom's Mabley. So this, I lived in San Francisco, but at this summer camp, Casadero Music Camp up in the Russian River, I met all these kids from Berkeley, and that's what really got me. So basically, when I went off to college, to Berkeley, L-E-E, College of Music in Boston, right out of high school. My mom sent me there. That's another cool-ass thing she did, kind of, but also kind of not really knowing that that's not really the greatest place to start your musical career, you know.
So no, you get chewed up and put in the grinder there, man.
Totally. And so I was like taking shrooms and acid every day. I was like, no, this place is not for me. So I come home at Christmas break and did not go back.
Really?
I was there 3 months or whatever. So I came back from that college, and my buddies from the music camp had a ska band in Berkeley that was playing sold out all ages shows, because all their high school buddies would come to the shows. And it was called the Uptones. And they were kids from Berkeley, and I was a little older than them. And all the kids, it was like a little mill of kids that were in high school and then slowly peeling off, going to college. And, you know, most of them had real careers and real jobs.
Right.
This band stuff was just for kids or whatever. So I was in that band the drummer went off to college, so I got the drum chair in that band. And they were making money. They were playing gigs. I was like, I'm not going back to music college. I'm working now.
Right.
And so anyway, from that band, I kind of, you know, there was a whole scene of bands, a ska scene kind of in the early 80s in the Bay Area. And I ended up jumping from that band to another band called the Freaky Executives. It was a 10-piece funk, more funk band. And they smoked weed, and they actually kept they divvied up the bread after the gig. Unlike the other little kid band where the manager took all the bread and hoarded it.
Nice.
But anyway, so and they didn't smoke weed. And so anyway, so it's funny how weed has guided my decisions in many decisions in life, you know. But anyway, so I started playing with this band, Freak Executives, and we had a pretty good local career, man. We had a big record deal, but the shit just fucking fell apart. I mean, it's just, you know, it was just like the classic example of a band that's, you know, got everything meant to be and just gets divided and conquered. And, you know, it's just the classic story, man.
Classic.
So, you know, big Warner Brothers contract, the shit ends up kind of falling apart. But while we were locally big there for a second, we rehearsed at this place in Emeryville, the warehouse where a lot of other bands rehearsed. And there was this dude named Les who had this band around the corner. It was kind of like King Crimson. I didn't even know his last name. It was this dude named Les. And he liked to smoke weed, so I'd go over there and smoke weed with him. And the drummer was cool. I was to go over there and geek out on drums with him. The drummer's name was Peter Libby, and he was one of the earlier drummers of Primus. So anyway, so I would hang out with those guys and smoke weed because I was at that rehearsal studio all the time. We Freaky Executives rehearsed like every day, so I was down there every day.
Have you gotten turned on to the Dead at all by that point?
Yeah, so I had a buddy. I had one buddy also from that music camp who was in the Dead, and I would go. He lived in Berkeley. I would take Bart over his house and spend the night. We'd just listen to records all the time, listen to records, and then he would put on the Dead a lot, and mostly to check out, you know, because we were drummers. He mostly to check out the drum stuff,
right?
Like that's like, and he knew I was into the more like choppy kind of playing and fusion and all that shit. So he you know, when he would play me the Dead, he'd try to play the more choppy kind of stuff, you know. But I never made it to see a show, you know. And but you know, the years went by, and what happened was Les Claypool called me one day and said, hey, I got this bass player Rob Wasserman who's hiring me to go play on a radio ad for Levi's jeans, and he wants to know if I know a drummer, and it was going to be upright bass, you know, and electric bass, and drums. So I went down to Hyde Street Studios, met Rob Wasserman. We recorded. John Cutler was there, doing the engineering, and it was the quickest, easiest $1,000 I ever made. I was like, oh, this is amazing. So then Rob called me up very shortly thereafter, to go up to Weir's house to play with them on a thing, on a musical.
The Satchel Paige Bob, thing, right?
That never saw the light of day, unfortunately. but this was late 1993, I think. And I had just gotten married.
At that point, though, how much at that point? So now all of a sudden you're in this world with Wasserman and Weir.
I didn't know anything about the Dead. All I knew to do was Touch of Grey. Touch of Grey is the only tune I fucking knew.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I knew some of the other shit just from like hearing it, maybe like, you know, peripherally, but I did not know shit. The funny thing is, I guarantee you, had I walked into that room meeting Bob Weir looking like I do today, knowing what I do today, I would have not got the gig at all. The fact that I had a crew cut Niners jersey, did not know a goddamn thing about the Dead. He was like, perfect. Wow. You know what I mean? And that's that. To this day, I always have to remember that. Like when I feel like, oh, here comes my turn to be in Further, or here comes my turn to be in the other ones. It's like, oh yeah, well they always go, okay, who's the obvious guy? No, let's get this other guy over here. Like, because when I first got the gig with Bob Weir, Prairie Prince was playing a lot, you know, because he had played with Vince
and the Tubes and all that, right?
And Prairie's a huge Deadhead. Huge fucking Deadhead, knows all the shit, and was playing with Bob, and I think he was just like, what the fuck? You know? I don't blame him, but the thing is, Perry would never, ever, I'm projecting this shit. I never got the vibe from Perry like that, Prairie, and I think he's one of the most kindest people I've ever met in my life, man. I can't, and it's a badass artist.
So at that point, now you got to start listening to the music and you got to get to know the music. And what, as you start checking out the Dead and really hearing what they were all about, you know, and giving it a chance, what was it that grabbed you from that music?
You're not going to believe it. The first shit I started listening to was Bob's Heaven Help the Fool album. And I was like, oh, killer, man. It's like fucking just, it's like Steely Dan. The Dead's just like Steely Dan. Oh, killer, man. It's all like produced up LA session cats. Oh, cool.
And then you come to find out that's not the case.
Not the case at all. So then there begins my long, strange trip, you know, of me becoming a born-again Deadhead. Having everybody in Rat Dog hating me because now I'm the fucking trying to tell everybody what to do. It's you know, I've run the gamut of fucking going from not caring about the shit to caring too much about it.
Right.
You know, as I'm sure you guys all have too, you know, it's like, there's so much in this music that it's almost hard not to find something you love or at least one song that like, cause like what ended up happening was, you know, when you're a professional musician, you're getting gigs. You're like, okay, I got a gig, learn the tunes.
Right.
Get a gig, learn the tunes. But do you covet what you're playing, or are you just learning the tunes just for the gig? You know what I mean? Like that's kind of the battle of being this in this musician kind of world, because half the time, you know, if you're a supportive player like we are, you're playing somebody else's music. Right. So and you know, hey, it might not be your favorite, but you gotta work. You gotta get a gig. So how much of yourself do you open to give to this shit? Because, like, honestly, man, when I played with Eaton and those guys, you know, and then and Skip, and then, you know, just hanging out watching you guys, that was so eye-opening for me, man, because here you guys are playing it like you played it. So you just play it in your sleep, just play it for fucking fun. You guys love this music so much, you know, and that just it's just like, wow, that it really gave me something to look forward to, because you really do get sucked into this world of people playing on gigs for the gig. They learn the tunes for the gig, and sometimes they don't really learn them. And there's, as you know, Rob, there's a lot of intricacies in this Dead stuff. Believe it or not, when I was out there at the soundboard watching you guys at Red Rocks, I was taking notes. I was like, oh, that's how this shit. Because, dude, honestly, man,
I'm flattered, man. Thank you.
Since I didn't listen to the Dead, and you get the gig with Bob Weir, and then you're trying to learn the shit through him, and he's the guy that was playing off all the other shit. And it's like, whoa, without all that other shit there, it's like, it's almost like a mystery how the fucking, like, I had such a hard time figuring out what the hell Bob is doing. But when you hear it, all the puzzle pieces put together, it's like, oh, there it is. There's that fucking sound.
I'm glad you touched that, because that was going to be a question later, because you've played with Bob probably more than anybody. And he plays guitar, especially rhythm guitar, unlike anybody in the world. You can't define what he does. My question, how hard was it to grasp how to play with that?
It's really hard, because some of the shit, he ain't playing shit.
Right.
Let's play this song. Okay, 2, 3, 4. Chink. Chingy. Like, wait. Man, the Dead played, everybody played rhythm in parts, mm-hmm. you know? Especially Keith had the really cool shit. But Garcia's parts, like, you know, a lot of times his shit sounds like a bass line to me. You know, like his shit's like, just fucking, there's so much stuff like Easy Answers. You know that song,
of course,
Easy Answers?
Sure.
That's the song I'm talking about. So it goes bum, 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 right? Mm-hmm. But there's actually a Garcia part in there that I finally heard. When I finally heard those Healy tapes, I gotta get another copy of that. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So Garcia goes bum, 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 bum. It's like, oh, there it is. Well, there's that thing that makes me not have to go don't pat, but all by my fucking
self. Sure. There's pieces of the puzzle that are missing at that point. Yeah. I want to go back then. Yeah. I want to talk about the drummers, because we're talking about, you know, now that we're talking about the band, obviously you interpret the music your own way, whether it's Further or Rat Dog or the Wolf Brothers, any Dead related groups you're performing with. But now you started having to listen to the music to get to know it. Is there anything that you would say that you take from Billy and Mickey that influences how you play?
Oh, dude, are you kidding? Like, the problem with me, I think, up until I really started trying to understand what the fuck is going on here, is I heard everything in parts.
Yeah.
What's the drum part? What's the fucking part? Everything was a 2, 4, 8.
And that don't work here.
And this shit is just like amorphous. The funny thing is after trying to finally kind of getting loosening up, I finally loosened it up after all these years. Then I go back and play with Claypool. He's like, what the hell are you doing, Jayski? What's all this fucking Mickey Hart shit?
Take it up, man.
Come on, man. Come on, Jayski. Go back to playing the parts. What's the part? I'm like, God,
two different worlds, man.
But yeah, it's, you know.
So I went from Billy. Let's look at Billy for a minute. What from his playing grabs you? What do you take from his playing most when you
interpret? Well, I every time I've tried to watch Billy, I go, okay, cool. Billy's playing tonight. I'm gonna go to the show. I'm gonna watch Billy. I'm not gonna hang out backstage. I'm gonna actually check him out, watch him. I swear to God, dude. Every time I've done that. Next thing you know, it's 2 a.m. I'm like, wait.
What happened?
What just happened? Oh, I know. He hypnotized me into partying. Is exactly what happened. I forgot about watching the drums. It was like, wait a minute. I was going to watch the drums. God damn it. Fuck.
It moved you, man.
It just moved me so much. I'm like, oh, hey, you started having a good old time. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I was going to watch the drums. Damn it. You know, because I can't tell what he's doing. He's so. You know, I was starting to wonder what the hell he's hearing. You know, and he said to me one time, just keep your ears real open, listen to everything and stuff. Like, all right, yeah, I'll try that too. I mean, I'll try that, but I was trying to think what he's hearing. What is he hearing? And I was wondering, and I'm still kind of wondering if, because. When you're playing the drums, what makes you decide to hit this drum or that drum or this cymbal or that cymbal? Is it a choice based on volume, or is it based on frequency? You know, or do you hear a frequency that's not being played and then you want to play it? And so that's what I was thinking, wondering if he's doing. Like, why would I go and hang out on the tom right now you know, and because I every time I try to do it, it feels like I'm poking out like a sore thumb. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Right. You know, so honestly, man, I'm going to skip around a little bit here, but I finally heard a Jerry Band recording of this goddamn Buzz Buchanan.
Yeah, man.
And I'm like, who is this cat, man? Because that's me. I hear me. It's a 1978 March whatever Veterans Hall fucking show. And I'm like, oh, man, this drummer is like, but he's not doing, he doesn't seem to be doing that Billy thing or anything else. And I really am feeling that thing. So I've been listening to that, like, all that's what I listen to when I just want to put on
some right music. On. He was so good, and he was such a short sliver of time where he's there too, you know.
Yeah, it was like two years.
Yeah, but he's pocket all the way, man.
I mean, unbelievable. And then somebody told me he's a lefty. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. What about Mickey? What about his point? You take anything out of that?
Well, Mickey is like, I can't believe how. Because sometimes I hear the slop, you know, and I'm like, but there's a beauty in it. There's something that you can't. It's like there's a skill in that slop, you know. It's unbelievable, man. I know there's something there that's incredible, and it kind of lightens the music for me too. And I really like double drumming is hard. You know what? Double drumming is not easy. And the times I've done it, I have not really liked it. Most of the times I've done it, I've only done it a couple times where it's like, okay, I don't feel like it's a battle.
Right.
Of who's
sure, man. Believe me, I know.
And you guys, I'm going to pick your brain about that a little bit too. See what your concept is about. Cause sometimes it's like, all right, you got it, man. Oh, now I got it. Oh, cool. No, now you got it. Okay, cool. But sometimes it's like, oh, you got it. Oh, now I'm going to play some toms. Oh, now you got the toms. Okay, I'll play some. Oh, now you're going to do that too? Fuck, I'll just sit here and do nothing. How about
that?
That
happens,
man?
Sometimes to both of us, you know? You're right, though. That happens sometimes to both of us where we'll even talk about it and say, you know, on that song, you were filling up so much space, there was nothing for me to do, so I had to lay out, you know?
Yeah. But at least you guys are figuring it out, though.
Yeah.
That's because I've been on gigs. I've done that thing with guys, great drummers too, that won't give you any.
Yeah.
They just it's like, well, why am I here? If you got it all, man.
Right.
You got the cymbals, you got the toms, you got the fucking this and that. Plus, you're looking over at me, telling me to shush or some shit. It's
right.
Like, all
that's,
right, man.
Sometimes what'll happen, you know, Dino and I have been playing together. We played together for 5 years before we joined Darkstar. So we've been playing together for almost 25 years. So now, you know, it's an innate thing because we have the book. I know a lot of my fills end on four just by nature, the way I play. A lot of my fills end on four, and he finishes that last beat going back into the one with the way he fills. And that just came naturally that we learned it. But we'll try and make a conscious effort a lot of time, like when there's a solo going on in a tune. We try and make a conscious effort for only one of us to be on the ride and one of us to be on the hat, but we never talk about who it's going to be. So there's certain times where we'll just start laughing because we both go like this, and then we see that, and we both switch back, and we both go you got it. Okay, I'm like, over here now.
No, go ahead.
All the time, and then we just start looking at each other and smiling because it's funny.
That's funny,
your ears got to be big. You got to put your ego aside a little bit more. Play a little less. But you know, it doesn't always work. There's plenty of times where I'll play a 16th note tom fill at the same time he's playing a triplet tom fill, and it sounds terrible. You know, we're bumbling over each other, slop, as you called it, you know?
Yeah.
You try not to have it happen, but even after playing together all those years, it's always going to happen, you know?
Oh yeah, you know? Totally.
Still with Billy and Mickey as well. Who were some of your other influences growing up drumming? You mentioned, Weather Report. So that's like 70. You said you were 14-ish. So that's Erskine back then.
Yeah, and I went and seen. I saw him too, man. I saw him at the Warfield
with,
man,
Peter Erskine. Nice,
yeah,
man. Who were some of your other influences?
Jocko, because Jocko played drums too. Right. And Billy Cobham, because everybody loved Billy Cobham because he was the one guy that played the. you know, back in the day. It's very Lenny White. I gotta say Freddie White, also the drummer for Earth, right. Wind & Fire. Probably a lot of guys who played on a lot of songs I love that I don't know their names, but David Garibaldi was a huge influence. Yeah. Man. That was funny too, because we did that first Further Festival after Jerry died, and Mickey's
Planet Drum had Garibaldi.
Yeah, but I think he called it Mystery Box.
Right. That was, I liked that band with the Mint Julep singing and everything. That was cool stuff. It's a great album.
But dude, the funny thing is like, it was like we were headlining, the Rat Dog headlined that tour. So every night it's like Giovanni, Dave Garibaldi, Zakir Hussain, Sikiru, yep. and Mickey, the heaviest drummers in the world. And then me on a little three piece kit right after him. But I got along with those guys great, man. I really did. I'm really good friends. Sikiru has actually come over to my house twice, just mess around and record.
Right on, man. Tell him I said, hey, I love him, man. Hello. He sits in with us, and it's just so cool. More textures. There you go. It's texture.
Dude, his one mic and his one little thing, when you got one of these like big jam things with ending jam with like fucking 20 people on stage, his shit cuts through all that shit through the PA, man.
On a little 6x12 drum. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like the biggest sounding thing. Like all that shit that Mickey has sounds tiny compared to that.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask you this, man. You've been parts of, we've talked about all the different projects, and it's they vary widely. You know, and some of them, like the Primus and the other stuff you do with Les, you're hitting pretty hard. But the stuff with Bob, especially lately, I don't know if it's more subdued or maybe subtle is a better word. Is there a reasoning behind that? Is there a mindset that you have to go through to come and play a little less aggressive like that?
Well, to be honest with you, I kind of prefer it. You know, it's easier. I'd like to be able to make more music with less effort. You know, to be honest with you, some of that Primus stuff, I felt like I was just trying too hard, and it was just like, the harder I sometimes I feel like the harder I try, the harder it is. The harder I try, the smaller it is. It's small. It's almost like I'm trying to get that Bruce Lee 1-inch punch out of the thing, you know. I mean, even when I play with Claypool, I actually did play another New Year's gig right before COVID shit. We played a Sausage reunion gig, opening up for his Claypool Lennon Delirium at the Warfield. And it was me and the original guitar player, Todd Huth, who actually I'm doing another project with. It was the three of us, and he called it Sausage. And we played, and it was like effortless, man. It was so fun. And I felt like I really finally, you know, it was one gig. But, I mean, I finally was able to, like, I didn't even feel like I was sweating at the end of the gig. Whereas, like, when I rejoined Primus in 2010, that was like some of the hardest work I've ever tried to do on drums. I feel, you know, I feel like that guy who took over from Keith Moon, the Burial Buff guy.
Kenny Jones,
but he's like, not that happening. But, you know, but super, super buffed and trained and all fit and all for it. But it's like, somehow I just could not, I felt like I couldn't fucking do it good enough somehow. Well, I was trying to fill some pretty big shoes. You know, Herb, the drummer who took over Primus and really created the drum sound for Primus and made them famous after I was in him. He joined in 1989. His shit is hard as hell to play. Yep,
it is.
And it's not my style at all. You know, I'm all up on top of the beat right there, matching Claypool's fucking rhythm. Right. Herb is like lumbering, kind of like pulling back. It's like that push and pull between he's pulling it and Claypool's pushing it. That's kind of what created that Primus sound.
I'm going to take it a step further, because with Wolf Brothers, you know, for the longest time when you guys started, like when last time I saw you here in St. Louis, it was a trio. You know, it was you and Bob and Don. And now it's like a 10-piece, I think, with Jeff and the horns and everything.
Yeah. No, I think Bob's really happy having it all filled in and stuff. I'm kind of like, I'm on the fence, because as great as it is with all the horn players and Jeff and Greg, I thought we were starting to get onto some shit with the trio, you know. It was, and Bob was starting to play. Bob was playing shit he'd never played before, you know, and I thought we were starting to grow, and he was starting to fill in a lot of these holes, and he was starting to play some shit Garcia played. He's like, oh yeah, that's that old claw hammer fucking shit that nobody knows how to play that shit. Garcia showed me himself. I was like, yeah, all right, man. But I think the focus of the tension being too much on Bob was too much for him. You know what I mean? I think he always likes to have another buffer, so he's not the main center of attention. It's too much on him to be the center.
That's kind of the rhythm guitarist mindset, you know?
Exactly.
I know it's very different. I love the arrangements with this eclectic combination of instruments, you know, a horn and a pedal steel together and all that. But when you go from the trio to the 10 piece, do you have to alter how you play to accommodate that, having more voices on stage?
I didn't really think about it. I didn't give it much thought, but to be honest with you, the only thing I'm doing different now is now that I've listened to that Buzz Buchanan cat, I'm just trying to play a shit like him. I was like, what would Buzz do?
That's the mindset, right on. You also started, we talked about this a little when we hung out at Red Rocks, but you started playing more electronic drums and cymbals now, which we had to talk about. What's the reason behind switching over to the electronic?
Well, I tried it out. I've been Bob likes low stage volume. It's a great concept. If you can get it, you know, to have a super light stage volume and then you hear yourself out of the house. Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, it's so cool. And I noticed I was trying to get quieter and quieter and quieter, trying to get quieter cymbals, trying to get quieter drum heads, quieter sticks, trying to hit quieter, everything quieter, quieter, quieter. And then I'm like, I listen to the tapes. I'm like, I sound like a pussy on the drums, man. I'm not playing shit. You know what I mean? And it's like, I got to fucking be able to play this shit with energy when it needs it and not feel like it's too loud for Bob or whatever. And I realized that again is another thing of frequency, because I think it's like there's times where it is okay. I think Billy does it really well. He knows when there's times between the vocals and all that where it's okay to hit smack it a little harder. Just make sure you're off the cymbals when he's singing and shit. You're not creating a long cymbal rings while he's trying to sing, or do a busy tom fill while he's singing a lick or some shit. So as I was still trying to get better in that, I also was, you know, I've always been into the electronic drums, and I've been noticing that the technology has really rapidly advanced with the pads and the sounds and everything. So I took a gamble. I was just like, okay, this shit is now to a level where it's kind of like in a big venue where it's like, it's so fucking, you're not hearing any acoustics off the stage anyway, like a big giant venue. I don't think it really matters.
It's all coming out of PA, right?
Yeah. I would never use that shit in a small club. Never.
Right.
Only on a gig where you're dependent on the PA and it's, you're not hearing anything off the stage anyway.
Right.
And I gotta say, Rob, I was nervous about doing it at Red Rocks. But and the first night we had a little technical glitches, and the settings on those things are a little different when you're in your room and when you're at the gig. It was just I was dicking with the velocity settings, trying to get it to really not be too dynamic. I was trying to get it a less dynamic range on the thing. And then we actually ended up putting a real kick drum head on for the last couple gigs we did. It was a lot better because the kick drum, now it's a real kick drum, which doesn't bother. That's not bothering anybody. So I went for it at Red Rocks, you know?
Yeah, man. And then when you and I were talking about it the next week when we were playing Red Rocks and you were out there, we were standing back in catering talking about the cymbals, because I was really surprised to see the electronic cymbals up there, because up to this point in life, electronic cymbals are pretty much sucked.
Yeah, no, but the shit is to a level now. I mean, this shit's been upgraded, man. And you know, I'm not trying to I'm not trying to fuck myself up on not being able to play. I wanted to see if the shit was dynamic, if I could do the right kind of dynamics and play like I normally play without changing the way I'm hitting the shit at all and have the shit still work. And I think, like, by the last Greek Theater gig we did, it did, man. You know, I can't smudge the drums as much as you can with real drums, if you understand what I mean. You know, smudge the shit together. You right. know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I know I hit this thing wrong right now, but I'll hit it right now. And it's just, that's how drum sound or whatever. But like, you almost have to think about like your notes a little bit better. But the funny thing is, when sometimes I'm listening to the fucking tapes back of the gig, it's like, that sounds, it's like, I can't, it's like, okay, that's, sounds cool. I mean, you know, he's processing the shit anyway. Right. It's like going through, it's a mic with a bunch of digital processing going through a digital board anyway. Right.
And the more you hear all that shit, I mean, every time you hear it and it sounds good, that's going to make you more comfortable for the next time out.
Yeah. So I finally got to a point where I went for it. But yeah, I had a real kit on standby. Trust
Did
me.
You?
We had mics. We had the shit all on standby. Did that shit go wrong?
Really?
And you know what? The only thing that went wrong was a D, because I'm using eight balanced outputs, quarter inch, and one of the fucking, and so you got to have eight DIs. And believe it or not, one of the DIs, the kick drum fucking DI fucking blew up. And here's me and Bob trying to fucking convince everybody else, including Don Was, super producer, that this is the shit. And I'm like, Don Was is probably talking big shit about me behind my back, man. He's like, and this motherfucker's playing V drums. God damn it. I got like a 1940 bass and shit, and this motherfucker's playing V drums.
You know what? You just mentioned Don, and that makes me want to ask a question that I hadn't thought about. But, you know, when you played with Rob and you played with Don, they're both primarily, they're playing upright. And when you play with Rob and he's yeah. playing electric, how different is that for you as a drummer?
Who's playing electric?
When Robin was in the band and he was playing electric. How different is it as a drummer to play these songs, these Grateful Dead tunes, these Bob songs, whatever it is, with an acoustic bass or an electric bass? Is there any difference?
I'd say I probably am not as concerned with dynamics as I am when it's an acoustic bass, because it's so softer. You know, I'm trying to fucking, you know, really dig in there. But Don and Rob had, I mean, they're both amazing players, and had like such a nice acoustic thing. And I never wanted to be too loud on top of that, you know. But then you got weird saying everybody turned down, but then he's fucking cranked. It's all hell. Yeah.
What else you got going on right now? You're sitting in your studio, I know that. So what else are you working on right now? You've had so much time at home, I'm sure you're messing around with something.
You know what I started doing, I wanted to redo some Grateful Dead stuff. So I started working on some stuff, and I haven't finished anything yet because I got so much shit, and I'm always resetting it up and rewiring it and fucking, you know, trying to add more shit. But and then every now and then something needs to go to the shop, and so I got fucking a month of waiting for something to get out of the shop. I'm working on a few things. I wanted to do there's an artist that was very underrated that I wanted to see if I could bring more attention to, a guy that played with the George Clinton and Funkadelic group and Ohio Players, actually. Very influential guy named Walter Junie Morrison. And I guess outside of the funkadelic world or whatever, not too many people know about him, but he was pretty influential songwriter, you know. And he has some obscure albums in the 70s and 80s that's got some interesting songs on it. And I was going to do a cover of one of them, and I'm working on that right now. Before I decided to relabel my entire patch bay last night, but then I was up till 1 a.m. doing that anyway. But he's got a song It goes something like, you know, if you show me yours, baby, I'll show you mine. And who knows what he's talking about. But I was going to do a cover of it and talk about your vaccination card.
There you go, man. Show me your
vaccination card. I'll show you my vaccination card.
I love that. All right. Hey, before I let you go, you got to do this with me. Every one of my guests, I pull this on them. It's a quick lightning round. Just going to ask you a bunch of questions. Just shoot from the hip. The first one. First show, you never really got to see the Dead, so I'm going to skip that first show one. First show you played with anybody in the Dead, how about that?
First show I played with anybody in the Dead. Well, I can't not say when I was at that Casadero music camp, because I have to add this anyway. There was a Brazilian percussionist up there named Jose Lorenzo, had a group called Batucaje, and he was working with Mickey Hart. 1979, my buddy, the same guy who used to play, we used to listen to Grateful Dead in his room, Jose asked the two of us if we wanted to come to a party at Mickey Hart's ranch in Novato. I think it was 1979, I think it was 4th of July. I think there was a stage set up outside. He had a barn. There was a barn there, whatever. Right. Big steal your face on the barn. My buddy, I see Ayerto, the famous percussionist, fucking passed out like by this fucking table of fucking alcohol, giant table of alcohol. And then there's Ayerto sleeping right there. And then fucking Bob comes walking out of the house, and my buddy goes, "That's Bob Weir." And he walks right by me. I go, "Hi." And he didn't say anything, you know, like, all right, whatever. And then nobody was playing. I think everybody's fucking drinking, who knows? So we were kids. So fucking, they go, "Hey, why don't you guys play? So I got up there and played, and they were like, "Hey, that was really cool. Do you know who you were just jamming with?" I was like, "Who?" They were like, "That's Bobby Vega."
That's cool, man. That's awesome.
So I'd have to say that's probably it.
That's a real good first show. Okay, Grateful Dead album, studio recordings or live tapes?
It's a tough one, man. I'd have to say live tapes.
Favorite Dead album?
Favorite Dead album? I can't choose Jerry Band, huh? I'd have to say Terrapin Station.
Okay, I'm gonna add another question in here. Favorite Jerry Band album?
Yeah, that fucking the
that 78 show.
78 show. It's on. I found it. It was on Apple Music. There's like a little series of Jerry Garcia. Right. Thing, and that all the logos look the same, and it's like volume whatever. It's a, you know, 1978 Veterans Hall.
Awesome.
March something, 1978.
Favorite non-Grateful Dead album, that Desert Island album, man.
Junie Morrison, and the album is called Evacuate Your Seats.
All right. First job.
My first job?
Yeah.
Was I think cleaning toilets at that summer camp.
Okay, favorite color?
Purple.
Mine too. A lot of drummers say purple. It's interesting. It's really interesting. Almost every drummer I've had on says purple, man. That's crazy. Favorite venue to play?
Oh, favorite venue would have to be anywhere outdoors without a proscenium is my favorite venue.
Best city for a day off?
Betty's best city for a day off, I'd have to say middle of fucking nowhere.
Okay. First car
was a Toyota that my mom gave me.
Current car.
What's that?
Current car.
It's a beat up ass fucking car that Claypool told me I had to buy because I was in Primus now and I couldn't be showing up in that fucking chipped up fucking Astro van. Or whatever the fuck I was riding around. And so he actually found me this fucking scratched up Mercedes at a used lot on a used Mercedes. It was a used BMW lot. It was a BMW lot in the used section. It was a C240 Mercedes. I'm still driving that, not 03. It's still got a cassette player in it.
Reading any books right now?
Not right now.
Got any magazine subscriptions?
Just tutorials online.
Gotcha. And, you know, this one, I don't know how, besides playing, what are you most excited to have back in your life, kind of, sort of, now that we're a little bit, now we're going back in now, but as we've been coming out of the pandemic?
Getting together, like, in my studio with other people. That's I got all this shit set up, and a lot of reasons that I don't finish shit is I hate my own fucking ideas. You know, I'll do something, it's like, that sucks. I need somebody in there. I would think my shit's cooler if I was showing off to somebody, probably, you know.
I know. You got to have that sounding board, man. Make sure it's good. I get it, man. I really do. Well, hey, man, this has been so much fun. I really appreciate you taking the time today. I know you got a lot going on, but again, that's Jay Lane, everybody. Thank you so much for hanging out with me today, pal.
Right on. Thanks, Rob.
My pleasure. We'll see you again soon.
Okay, brother.
Well, that brings us to the end of yet another episode. I'd like to thank Jay Lane and Garrett DeLoyan for being here. I'd also like to thank my sponsors, The Clean Store, The Authenticity Academy, and Grateful Sweats. I should also mention that Brad Sarno and I have had a little trouble getting together to put some segments together for you, but we're working on it, and hopefully the Sarno Music Solutions breakdown will be back very soon. If you enjoyed the show and would like to support the cause, please consider a monthly Patreon subscription that offers great bonus content every week, or you can show your love with a one-time contribution. And please remember that a portion of your contribution will go to the Rex Foundation. Get info about this and everything related to the podcast at our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. Any love is very, very much appreciated as we try and keep this show rolling along. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team of Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner, Dino English. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode number 20. Yes, we have made it to number 20. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant, folks. We got to get this going in the right direction again. We really want to be able to keep playing, and right now I'm very skeptical that we're going to be able to get the concert scene back to normal anytime soon without everybody's help. So please take care of yourselves and think about everybody around you as well. Thanks for being here. People join in the hand while the music plays the band. Looks at us on fire. Really, it's just going better. Balls and lightning roll along. All men sing about the truth. Will and I'm a jealous we go.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.